You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Sick.
And Sick and I will be taking a look at The Man from Atlantis. I'm going to have to bleep that, you know? This is a family-friendly podcast.
Two pieces of garbage.
Let me just go into a little brief disclaimer here. Last time we talked about Man from Atlantis, we decided that, well, frankly, this show is not really worth an hour or 40 minutes per episode because they're really pretty ugh. And, but...
You're far too kind.
But they were... Perhaps anyone who may have followed Fusion Patrol's Twitter feed would know that I watched through all of the Man from Atlantis's in order a couple months ago, or 3 months ago, or it seems like an eternity now, but not long enough for me to have forgotten them. And it is my observation that each and every episode of Man from Atlantis, each one is worse than the one before it. Now, that's pretty impressive, and, of course, you can't keep going forever. And when they reached the third-to-last episode, they reached the absolute nadir of television in the world. And then the next two episodes were actually not quite as bad, so it broke the pattern once they reached a point. And I can tell you that there was an experiment in 1967 in the Congo, where a group of researchers took a tribe of chimpanzees and set them loose in a television studio. And they produced better work than the worst episode of Man from Atlantis. So what we want you to know is that the first episodes we did were sequentially in order, and they were just reasonably insipid. But now we've decided to kind of leap forward in time and pick a couple of, in this case, thematically similar episodes. These are the time travel episodes of The Man from Atlantis, and they are quite a bit further down, 10 and 12, I believe. Yes. So they have gone beyond insipid, and now they are just to the truly insulting.
Beyond the pale.
Yeah. They still get worse yet than this. But,
yes, they do, unfortunately.
But these are bad, and we're not going to mince words about how truly
awful. We're not going to sugarcoat this, no way.
These are really bad, so we'll launch in episode 10 is called Shootout at Land's End. And, well, I'll just give you the quick overview. Mark Harris, we start off, and it's the Old West. And it seems like Mark Harris is a gunslinger named Billy Jones or something. Don't care what his name is, but Billy.
Actually, Billy Jones, I think, is right.
I think, yeah, it's a pretty generic name. Kind of Harris-like, Jones-Harris. Anyway, and he seems to be a gunslinger, and he gets mighty fresh with the farmer's daughter, and she stabs him. Meanwhile, on the cetacean, seemingly in the modern day, Mark Harris feels the agony of a stab in his shoulder, and he realizes that he must point the submarine west and then get out and go swimming. And when he does so, he comes out on the shore at near the town of Land's End in the 1890s, I guess.
It's the Wild West.
It's the Wild West. And no explanation, no... And there, he tries to find his identical twin brother, Billy, so that he can find out about his own origins in history. And along the way, reform him from being a hired gunslinger hand and turn him into a hero like Mark Harris. It's an insane premise. It's just an insane premise. I mean, there's absolutely nothing given with regards to how he travels back in time. And it works both ways. You swim east off the place, and you come back to the cetacean.
Travel into the future.
And it's not just Mark.
Nope, Billy does it.
Billy does it, too. And back and forth. So there's obviously something there, but we'll get to that, why that offends me, a little bit later. So did you like this episode, Ben?
Please.
What stands out?
All I can say, you know what stands out? Is that for a second there, I thought, ooh, is this a prequel to the TV series Dallas?
Well, Dallas, I believe, was set in the modern day. So
I know,
that would have been quite
a... Well, but the thing that I thought was interesting is this episode either had actors that had been in Westerns or actors that were destined to be in Westerns.
Okay, now let's talk about Purnell Roberts here for a second. Purnell Roberts is the main baddie in this episode, and Purnell Roberts used to be the oldest son on Bonanza. And later went on to star in Trapper John M.D. And do you know why Purnell Roberts left Bonanza before its run was over?
Actually, I have no idea.
He left because he felt that television was insipid and that it was a terrible waste of his craft, and the writing was awful. And so he left for a proper stage career. Now,
obviously, it didn't pan out.
The fact that he came back to do this episode of Man from Atlantis must have been like eating a big dog turd of humble pie, because, wow, this is bad. And I mean,
this episode is everything that he said was wrong with television.
Yes.
And worse.
And it has no redeeming qualities. But let's see. It's a standard Western. You see, there's the cattle baron played by Purnell Roberts, and he's a rich man because he's a cattle baron, and he's got a spoiled rotten son, which I think is very interesting. We never see his son.
No.
His son is a major plot point, Luke, but we never actually see him because he killed the farmer's son, and he got put in jail, and he's going to hang for it. Of course, the cattle baron doesn't want that. He wants the boy out of jail. He brings in Billy Jones, the hired gunman, to help throw some weight around to get his boy out of jail, which includes things like, you know, burning out the editor of the newspaper and, you know, the standard rotten cattle baron cliche from Westerns. There's also some other cliches. Let's just keep them going. He's in love with a saloon girl, the bad guy. And he's jealously in love with a saloon girl, and Billy's making time with her. And you wonder, is this a family show? Because it's kind of, you know, it's a little more than you get out of Gunsmoke with the saloon girls, but it's not.
I don't know. It's kind of hard to go beyond Mae West.
Yeah, but that
and
wasn't
the way
television.
She used to throw her. True, but the saloon gal character in Gunsmoke was
Miss Kitty.
Miss Kitty. She was a bit saucy.
More so on the radio before it became a television program. But you know, there were some implication here of what was going on because they were there on, you know, kind of undressed.
Oh, implication, please.
Yeah. Well, for 70s TV, of course, and our hero Billy likes to take long baths.
Imagine that.
He does. But he doesn't seem to have to breathe the water.
He just likes being in it.
He just likes being in the water. Mark, of course, meets up with the farmer and his daughter, who is also sort of Billy's love interest, except that she hates him because he's a bad guy. But yet she obviously, you know, has a thing.
Oh, she likes bad boys.
Oh, man. And they give Mark Harris, you know, he comes up naked, and they give him some clothes, and they teach him, well, they don't teach him to ride a horse, but they, of course, put him on the buck and bronco.
Dark eye.
You know, so that he can be embarrassed.
Because it's his initiation.
It's initiation. But
it's tradition.
And he does get thrown, but unlike...
Only once.
Then he goes back and he talks to that horse just like he would a dolphin.
But you know what bugs me about... Here he says that he's told Dark Eye is an exceptional horse. So after everybody has his big laugh, he says, "No, I want to do this again because Dark Eye is an excellent horse." How does he know? How does he know that Dark Eye is an excellent horse?
I'll tell you one step further. I've always wondered this because when he throws him off, they say, "Oh, that's all right. Nobody can ride Dark Eye." That happens to everyone.
They say, "Well, Dark Eye, you rode Dark Eye longer than anybody."
And then I ask this question: why keep a horse like that around?
It's cliche.
Yeah, it's cliche. But why would a farmer keep a horse nobody can ride around? It doesn't make any sense. But there you go.
It's cliche.
It's cliche.
It's been in movies going back, I don't know how long, but it's not the first time I've seen that particular plot gimmick.
So Mark and Billy meet up. They're amazed at the appearance. Mark is, of course, his usual breathless sort of, "You know, I know you're a good guy, and do you know anything about us and what happened to you?" And we learn a little bit about Billy. Apparently, Billy washed ashore with amnesia and all beat up and adopted the prince, knows nothing. So exactly the same
situation as Mark, except just in a different time period.
And he looks just like him. You know, are they clones of Mark throughout time, or I don't know. But
well, except for one thing.
Well,
Billy does not have a webbed hand.
Yes, he does. I had to watch through the thing twice.
Well, actually, he did.
He's got scars.
He's
removed his webs.
He has removed his webs, but I actually did see it at one moment. I caught that too, and I, at first I thought maybe that was a gaffe because I had read some spoilers saying that he had removed his webbed hands because he couldn't handle a gun.
That's exactly what he says to Mark. He's talking to him. They're talking about each other. And before he looks at Mark's hands, he says, "You got webbed hands?" And Mark shows him the webbed hands. And then Billy puts his hands up, and he doesn't. But it's a pretty poor quality picture. But you can kind of see where it looks. Frankly, it looks like where the glue for the webs came off the hands. But
yeah.
And he says, "Webs not very good for a gunfighter." And the first time through, I didn't take it the way it was probably meant to be taken, but the second time through, you know, looking at it, it's like he's saying, "Yeah, I removed them because I couldn't shoot a gun.
I couldn't work with them.
Yeah, couldn't work with them." So, so he is Mark Harris, and notice Mark doesn't have funny eyes anymore.
No,
and he didn't seem to need his glasses, and he seems to be capable of functioning. Billy, in particular, seems to be able to function
very well.
Very well.
Outside of water.
And never goes in the water to breathe. In any case, Billy decides that it would be better if he took over Mark's life. And so he chains up Mark, throws him in the corral, and he swims out a mile to the cetacean, stealing Mark's underwear or swim trunks while he's at it. And gets on board the cetacean, where he's quite fresh on Dr. Merrill. Has the stab wound
right
in his body, which Dr. Merrill sees and is amazed by. The fact that this guy is terrified of telephones.
He seems completely bewildered by the technology around him.
Talks all in a southern, in a cowboy kind of way, and is
well, not so heavily of a draw,
not
but certainly the verbiage.
Yeah, it's all wrong, and of course he's going on
it's
about how you don't have guns on the ship, and who are you going to protect yourself against? And it's all, you know, any idiot could see that this is not
Mark
Harris, particularly since he's got the wound. But obviously
right,
they believe it.
Clearly, Elizabeth buys it.
She buys that there's something wrong with him mentally.
But she still thinks this is Mark.
And so Billy, once he sees a guy come up on the TV screen, and he thinks that Jomo, I think it is, the navigator,
yeah,
has been jammed into a little box on the screen. He decides that this is not for him, and he heads back out to Land's End, where you know, owing to a series of mishaps with Mark and the saloon girl, which the bad guy has seen and now thinks that Billy is carrying on with his girlfriend, which is actually true, but not why he discovered it, they decide to lynch him. Mark has escaped.
By rolling into
a horse trough.
Horse trough filled with water. And now we have Super Mark.
And he can snap the chains. And he... and then Billy's whipped before he's lynched. And Mark feels that, and it's a lot of pain for him because they're interconnected. When they're this close, they can feel each other's pain. And so finally he gets a group together to go rescue him, save him from being lynched, you know, with a cliche, shoot the rope as they're dropping him off the lynching
thing.
They're
about to hang him.
And so then the bad guys go to Spring the Sun, leaving because they think they've been surrounded. And Mark teaches Billy a valuable lesson. He takes him under the water tank, and they take a shower together. And in so doing, Billy's restored because of the water makes him, the whippings on his back feel so much better. And it's just awful.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awful.
I just sat. I cannot describe to you the reactions that I was having watching this episode. It was agony. It was incredibly stupid.
It was stupid. That's exactly right. This is one of those ones where you're watching people and you think the writer just thinks you people are stupid, and I'm gonna just give you stupid.
I wonder if somebody came along and says, you know what? We know it would be really nice. I mean, it might help save on production costs. We've got a backlot that has an Old West set. Let's use it.
Well, that's the standard Universal Old West set, I think, back there.
It's either Universal or Warner's.
Oh, you know, another thing that gets me is that Mark's wandering around this town. He knows there's an identical guy named Billy. And people keep coming up to him and calling him Billy and telling him stuff and getting him confused. And not once does he ever say to these people, except for the very first person he meets, not once does he ever say, I am not Billy. My name is Mark Harris. He never even bothers to try. He just goes along with it. I want you to burn down the editor and burn out his house. And it's like, you wish me to burn the editor? Yes, Billy. Why are you talking that way? I do not understand why you wish to burn. It's like... Because I'm...
Especially if Mark's clearly expressed an interest in trying to
find Billy.
So if you want to find him, wouldn't it be in your best interest to actually say, I'm not Billy, I'm Mark, how can you help me find him?
Yes, but no. It's completely... And it's got some of the worst split screen shots I've ever seen, where they have to get the actor in the screen twice. I mean, just terrible. Not that that was ever a great effect, but I mean, some really bad stuff.
Well, this also, the video quality was pretty poor.
It was pretty poor, but some of them are obviously really, like they're in two different rooms and they've just butted them up against each other. I mean, it's pretty bad, but... and then the final thing that was a ridiculous cliche is that Billy and Mark team up now to save the town, prevent Pernell Roberts from breaking his son out of jail, who deserves to die. And they ride into town, and they come in right behind Pernell Roberts, who's shooting up the jail. I mean, right behind him. And he doesn't know they're there. They're like 25 feet behind him. And they run off and hide in the
laughing.
Bushes.
They're laughing. Well, at least Billy's laughing.
Yeah, they hide in the bushes.
Hear him.
If they had wanted to stop him, all they had to do was to walk up behind him, stick his gun in the back of his head, and it would be over. But they don't.
Give him a nice pounding on the back of the head, and then, you know, knock him out.
Or even just, you know, put the gun to him and say, "I'm taking you into the sheriff. You're under arrest." But he doesn't do that. Instead, they sneak around the back of the town, around all the guys surrounding the jail, sneak into the jail through the back door, which is apparently unguarded. And they have to ask the sheriff if they can be deputized, and he gives them badges. Once they've done that, then they can go out and they can stop the bad guys. Because according to Billy, I guess if I'm going to be like this, I might as well make it legal from right. now on out. And then, of course, then it's no problem for two water-breathing and Mark being superpowered, but Billy doesn't seem to be superpowered. I mean, if Billy is superpowered, then he doesn't realize he can bust down doors and break chains. But there you go. But so the end of the show, and Billy goes off to live his life as a straight guy now with the farmer's daughter. Who's, you know, all happy. Because last time, at the very beginning of the episode, he was trying to steal a kiss from her. He grabbed her up on his horse, and he was kissing her, and she took his knife and stabbed him. And this time, she says to him, "Billy, if I catch you trying to do that again, next time, I might just help you." Which is,
What?
Exactly. And, job. So, but all that horrible episode, nothing to redeem it. But there's one thing at the end that just drives me mad. Mark swims back out to the cetacean, gets on the cetacean, no longer has the stab wound on his shoulder that Billy had. Tells Elizabeth his story.
And she's not buying it.
And she doesn't believe him.
No.
Not at all. She thinks
that he had some kind of a mental breakdown instead of actually taking what Mark is saying at face value when he's saying, "That was not me. Yes, we know that you were not yourself. No, Elizabeth, that was not me. Hello, you've got all the physical evidence. It was right there."
She thinks he's so crazy that he physically manifested a knife wound on his shoulder. I mean, which is crazier? A guy who doesn't know you and can also swim underwater, I admit, is a little bit weird. But taking the premise of the show, I think we can buy off that that's a viable option and is an identical duplicate of Mark Harris. How do we know? Maybe everyone in Mark Harris's species looks just like Mark Harris. And I mean, she doesn't know anything about him. But she won't believe. And I mean, this is a scientific vessel. They could easily test that by simply having somebody put on a diving suit and swim with Mark and go back there. It doesn't appear to be closed off or anything.
No, I mean, the fact that Billy was able to make the trek. Having Elizabeth say what she did ranks right up there with that wonderful scene that you and I both berated to no end from Killer Spores, where Elizabeth talks about it. Well, you know, I don't understand it, therefore it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have again. All the evidence is right in front of her. No, Mark, that really was you. You just weren't yourself. No, Elizabeth, that wasn't me. Yes, but Billy, whatever.
I think there's not much we can say for this episode except it's truly dreadful, and it's only number 10. And
I know, there are still
worse to come. So let's talk a little
bit. Let's go worse.
Let's go worse. Let's talk about The Naked Montague, number 12. Some of you might recognize the name Montague. That would be the name from some play that's moderately famous by some English guy, writer
from long ago.
Yeah, a few people. You may have been forced to read this when you were in high school or something. Let's give it its due. There's some sort of equipment that Mark is installing for seismic activity undersea. Apparently, he's just now a delivery boy. And he's out there.
Well, he's a very effective delivery boy. I mean, well, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's true. He's good at this. Just swim out, drop it off. Off we go. He's out there and putting in this hypersensitive seismic activity monitor. And he, like, suddenly calls the sub and says, quick, get on yellow alert. And he swims back saying there's going to be an earthquake or something. And they're like, well, the new seismic monitor's working, Mark, and there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that there's going to be any kind of volcanic activity or anything out here. And Mark says, well, your seismic instruments cannot pick up an activity before it happens, implying that he can sense things before they happen.
Well, to be fair,
and
I don't
think
animals.
It was...
Yes.
And the fish, too, yes.
Now, it is scientifically documented. We don't know why, but animals do seem to have some kind of an understanding. They can hear it.
It's
on a frequency that we can't.
It's it's been documented. I don't know that it's been properly scientifically documented on that one. I've read some interesting papers on how badly the statistical analysis is done on that. That it's well within the margin of error bars that those stories are apocryphal. But anyhow, yes, that is what happens. All the sharks and fish swim away.
They all swim for cover.
And then Mark, of course, says, you know, I think it's got something to do with that theory you have about the plates of the Earth moving.
Tectonic plates.
The tectonic theory? It's like,
the tectonic
wow,
theory? I thought, no, it's a theory in 1977?
Actually, the tectonic, well, yeah, it is a theory. It's still a theory. I mean, that's in science, a theory is really what you shoot
yeah,
for.
Yeah,
but it's surprising. No, surprisingly enough, actually, the plate tectonics is... as plate tectonics, okay, now that's the important part there. Continental drift was earlier. Plate tectonic theory is late 60s.
Late
60s, early 70s.
I mean, yeah, I could see maybe
obviously
it's
for
still
lay
a theory,
audiences.
Still, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm jaded in the 21st century, but I don't know. It just.
Yes, it was.
The
it
line
was,
bothered me.
It was. Yes, it bothered me as well because it was so. Sort of, I'm just throwing something out here I don't really understand, but kind of thing on the writer's behalf.
Well, to make them sound all intelligent.
So, yeah, I did that. So there's, Mark goes out after, because then there's a big landslide and a sea view or the cetacean is sloshed around. And then Mark goes back out and he finds a hole in the mountain. A rift, and he goes in it, and then there's a cave in, and now this is the part that last time he swam,
and he swam ashore.
This time he goes into an underwater cave that's too deep for most submersibles, and the ceiling collapses on him, and he wakes up at a fountain. In 14th century Verona.
Verona.
Miles from
the
sea.
In the middle of the square.
In the middle of the city square. And he just
miles
happens...
Miles from water.
He just happens to be fortunately met by a friendly chap by the name of Romeo Montague and Imagine. His pal Mercutio. And if those names don't mean anything to you, here's Ben to explain it.
Romeo and Juliet. Enough said. Move on.
Oh, yeah. It's that play guy. Yeah, it's from that Shakespeare.
This is right out of a Shakespearean story.
And
but told much worse.
Well, we'll get to that. And they realize this man's been hurt because he's been kind of unconscious and naked. And they
Again.
Take him, yeah, and they take him to Friar Tuck.
No, not yet. First, they
well, they're
take
starting
him,
to take him to Friar Tuck. What's his
not,
name?
No, actually, I think they're taking them to Romeo's home to give him clothes.
No. They said they were taking him to the friar.
Oh, that's right. They're going to take him to the. Take that's him, right.
The medicine
friar,
man.
Whatever.
Yeah, and it is the friar from the darn play, but I cannot for the life of me think of his name. He's the wise friar. He knows much about medicine and other things. And on the way, they run into this chap by the name of Tybalt, who's quite the nasty piece of work he is. He's just itching for a fight.
I wonder why.
And he's just wants to fight with the naked guy, too, because I think he's got issues. But Because he now calls him the Naked Montague. Hence the name.
By virtue of being in Romeo's company, he must be a Montague.
Yes, obviously so. I think it's the jaw. It's the heroic jaw that's kind of fit with the Montague family more than the kind of slimy Capulets. But anyhow, I'm just picking sides there in that feud. I'm sorry. I kind of sympathize with the Montagues.
I think you're supposed to.
Am I supposed to?
The way they told the story.
Oh yeah, all right.
In this episode, right. Yeah.
Hell, who cares?
Do we just want to start bashing it now?
Nah. Oh, this thing is so awful.
This is the one. As much as I really detested Shootout at Land's End, this episode...
At least that was fiction. I mean, well, at least that was just sort of like a simple time travel stupid story with a replica of Mark thrown in. So it wasn't a simple stupid story.
But here you're actually taking a literary work, a literary classic.
Some would say a classic, indeed.
I mean, it's not one of my favorites, but it is so well known that in some literary circles, it must be regarded as a classic.
And you have the balls, as the writer, to try to change it for the purposes of this. That one, correct. And it's not just, I mean, I've seen lots of shows where they use the Romeo and Juliet premise.
It's a common theme.
Yeah, I mean, and it's being taken right from Romeo and Juliet. They, you know, our families are feuding, but they don't have the temerity to actually call them Romeo and Juliet. And at times, and I might point out at the wrong times, actually use Shakespeare's words.
This is the thing that just, one of the things that absolutely put me over the edge. Mark is supposed to be in Verona. What do they speak in Verona?
They speak, Mark speak. The TARDIS.
Yeah, they speak Mark speak, yeah.
The TARDIS is translating for him. Yeah, they didn't.
Oh, so this is a Doctor Who episode.
Apparently so, yes. This is the last Russell T. Davies episode that didn't get aired. All right, that was unfair. That was, I take that back. I may have
no,
some...
No, that was so fair.
Even Russell
Actually,
T. Davies
no,
couldn't
that's
have
not,
done this.
No, you're right. That's not fair, because even Russell couldn't write something this god-awful bad.
No, even if he tried. And so, but it's filled with all the... It's filled with... Well, and of course, they're talking in normal English. Right? I mean, normal 1970s English to Mark Harris, except... When they go, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks?
And talk about saying it at the wrong moment of the story, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's like when she's coming down for them to get married in secret.
It, I mean, okay.
And then she's like, Romeo, what? Romeo, wherefore art thou? It's like, wait.
Doesn't belong there.
That should be like at the party scene or something, isn't it? Or... I mean, it's been a few years since I've seen that play, I have to say.
It's a scene in the play where Romeo is having a secret rendezvous with Juliet, and she is in the just outside of her window, the little balcony outside of her window.
He's
calling to her, and that's how it goes in the story.
I thought when he said, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks, he spies her in the window. And that's what causes him to soliloquize. Well, it doesn't really matter. In this case, it's just he's actually saying it to her.
And it is so out of place.
And am I not mistaken? And again, I fully admit it's been 30 years since I've seen or heard any adaptation proper of Romeo and Juliet. But am I not correct in that Mercutio is killed?
Mercutio is supposed to be dead.
It dies. And
I'm willing to bet that it was because Mark was there at the beginning of this story.
Yes, I think that is the point where
Mercutio was not dead.
When they killed Tybalt at the end, and they asked him about his wound, was that not Mercutio's line? Something about the wound is not as deep as a well, nor as wide as a door, but it will do?
probably.
I was thinking that was Mercutio's dying lines, but I didn't bother.
It probably was.
So it's all messed up. But
it proceeds to get even more messed up.
But they do still have the naughty nurse. They have the naughty nurse. I like that. She has a hots for Marx, of course. Of course
she does.
I particularly like where she said the line of how, you know, it's so important. The mark of a gentleman, or something like, it's so important where and how a gentleman sheaths his sword.
Oh boy, talk about innuendos!
Oh, it's like, he's just like, I'm glad the kids aren't watching.
Well, that one got past the censors too.
yeah. So, anyway, I think you know the story. The Capulets and Montagues, they hate each other. They're fighting. Romeo and Juliet love each other. It's a forbidden love. They secretly get married. And then the wise friar, who in this case, I cannot think of his name, and I should.
I don't have it. I thought I had it, but I don't.
He has two parts to play in this. One, he knows the tale about the strange fish that occasionally show up near the... near the fountain in the center of town every once in a while, surrounded in a pool of salt water.
Which comes from a hot spring or something?
Well, I mean, one, it's like, first off, if you found a fish on the ground near the fountain in the center of town, surrounded by a pool of salt water, I ask you, how do you know it's salt water? And then
because it's pretty much dried up.
It would be mud, and you'd have to taste it to know if it was a pool of salt water. And then there's a grotto far across the other side of town,
the other side of Capulet land.
Yeah, past the Capulets, past the friary, out into the hills, into a grotto where there's the dark grotto, where sometimes you can hear the sound of the ocean, which Mark thinks might be his way back. And they kind of speculate that maybe if some water might have flowed down and through and washed you up to the fountain. But it kind of seems like we're talking miles there.
And so, yeah, if we're talking miles, then obviously it would have to be an enormous amount of water, and you'd think people would know.
Like a tsunami kind of amount of water, yes. But apparently not.
Unless there's some sort of underground reservoir that came through the well or the fountain that Mark was next to.
But
because he was next to some like well of sorts.
But why wasn't he in the fountain?
Yeah.
Instead of next to fountain. But neither here nor there. We're not trying to make sense out of this story. So back to that story thing. The prince always seems to show up at the wrong time whenever they're fighting, and he's a stern authoritarian. If you guys keep fighting, I'll throw you in jail. And of course, Tybalt too stupid to stop fighting, so he just keeps picking fights, and the prince keeps showing up and getting people in trouble. So Romeo and Juliet decide to secretly get married because they know that will put an end to this bloodshed. Turns out it doesn't.
No.
No, actually, it pisses people off even more. And so, Romeo is banished from the city, and Juliet takes a crafty potion, also made up by the wise friar, that will make her appear dead. In the original story, Romeo hears of her death and comes back, and kills himself, and then she wakes up, sees him dead, kills herself, and it's what they call a tragedy.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, a mix-up. But in this case, Mark hears that Juliet has killed herself. The friar has sent somebody to find Romeo to tell him she's not really dead, which is where the other one goes all wrong. And Mark comes in, the friar says, She took this, and he hands him the vial for some reason, the vial of poison. which Mark seems to be touching the outside, and then kind of has this wise look like,
I know what this is.
I see, I know what this is.
Well, we've seen him use that little talent before.
It's as if he realizes, oh, she's not dead. That's what I get out of it.
Yeah,
but,
I got it too.
But he then leaves, and he swims back to the cetacean, where he tells Elizabeth and CW his story,
who don't believe him.
He's had a trauma. He's been under a rock slide. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's had a fantasy about this book. What book? Romeo and Juliet. I've never heard of this.
Read Romeo and Juliet.
Well, obviously you have read the book, Mark.
You just don't remember.
You fantasized about it, and he did not. Why would I do this? And he gives Elizabeth the vial and has her analyze it. And she comes back and she says it's a complex, get this, analgesic.
It's a complex aspirin.
It's a painkiller. And they tell him the story about, of course they tell him about how that they kill each other and she's not really dead, and then Romeo comes back and kills himself, and Mark's like, oh my gosh, and he swims off back into the rift, back up through the dark grotto, on the way, and gets back just in time to stop Romeo from killing himself. Of course, they have to fight a little bit first, so that then Juliet wakes up, and everyone lives happily ever after, which now is called a comedy in Shakespearean parlance.
Yeah, it's true.
And some would argue this is a better ending because, I mean, let's face it, the other ending was a bit of a downer.
Sad.
Yeah, this is a lot happier. I mean, the everybody's happy and Tybalt's dead, which makes me happy. And Mercutio lived, I think.
And yeah, he lived to the end of the story.
And Romeo and Juliet
all the
together.
Good people lived, all the bad people died. Mark saved the day at the very end. Mark actually did something, and this is another thing that bothered me regarding Mark and his role in the story. He had no role in the story. He was an observer, really, throughout almost all of this.
For most of it, that's right. He was just walking along.
This TV show is called The Man from Atlantis, and instead we have The Watcher. Because that's all he did.
Up until the
very end of the episode, he takes a little bit of action and changes the outcome of the story that we all know so that Romeo and Juliet can now literally live happily ever after.
And he goes back to the cetacean. And, of course, they still don't believe him. They go back to the Institute. CW explains how much he doesn't believe him. Elizabeth talks about how he doesn't believe him. Mark says, but what about this artifact? And Elizabeth's like, well, it is an ancient Italian artifact that's in a remarkably good condition, considering how long it must have been under the ocean. And it did have that chemical in it. But, of course, it didn't happen, Mark. And so what does Mark do? He says, well, in that case, I'll just take this and throw it back in the ocean. And he leaves to throw the artifact away. Again, this just is totally, totally antithetical to the idea that these are explorers or that Mark, that they value Mark.
For people that are, okay, now CW, okay, he's a paper pusher. He's an idiot.
Well,
but for Elizabeth,
yes,
who's supposed to be a scientist.
And has the hots for Mark, obviously.
Well, here's the thing. We have seen a complete change in character in Elizabeth from the way she was in the pilot.
Yes.
In that pilot film, we see this woman who is really thinking outside the box. She's thinking so far outside the box that, you know, everybody else thinks she's a loon.
Yep.
Now she's behaving like a Luddite.
And of course, she's living in a world where she's floating around on a submarine with a guy who breathes water. She should be able to think outside the box a little bit.
And she's not.
Even if this weren't the Elizabeth, you know, even if like Elizabeth had left the show and a different scientist had come along,
it wouldn't matter. Anybody who is with any kind of scientific credentials, they're going to need to keep something of an open mind. Granted, now let's be honest in one thing here. If we're just going to take the premise of what Mark is doing and his little hopping through time. And by the way, I should say something. The ocean, not a safe place. Not if it's going to start throwing you all to these different places in time. It's clearly not a safe place to be swimming, let alone driving your sub.
That's true.
That notwithstanding.
Well, it is the final frontier.
Oh, wait, that's space. Heck yeah. If we're going to accept the premise that these things happen in this universe that this TV show is taking place, then
for no apparent reason,
and obviously, and you know, and Dr. Merrill has seen it in her rescue of Mark, then we must also assume that it is possible for these little time jumps from to happen to Mark, you know, by swimming through these fissures or swimming through these very unusual holes in the bottom of the sea, taking you to different places and different lands and different times. We must assume that these things can't happen. And here we have Dr. Merrill, who in the beginning of the very beginning of the series seems to embrace that philosophy and now has just completely closed herself off.
Her character has been thoroughly
totally closed-minded
and destroyed. And when later in the series the actress playing that part seems to disappear, first with "Where is Elizabeth?" "Oh, she's still in Washington," for like one episode, and then the next episode she's not even in the opening credits. I couldn't find any dirt on that. But I would like to think that it's Belinda J. Montgomery telling them to go take a hike.
I mean, I would like to think that she was seeing these scripts, and as soon as she saw,
because it's right after the worst one.
Ooh.
Then that's like her last story, and then she's out of there. She's name checked in the next one, and then she's not even name checked in the one after that. I mean, it's gone.
I'd have left too. I'm sure she was desperately trying to get out of her contract and finally saw. I don't know. Maybe they knew that the series was going to be canceled. At that point,
I can't imagine that they didn't know the series was going to be canceled at this point.
Well,
I mean, let's face it. On 1970s television in the United States, when you try to bring in Shakespeare to boost up your ratings, you know you're desperate.
Yeah.
So these two episodes are dreadful, and they're just dreadful. I can't explain just how dreadfully dreadful they really are, but they're really dreadful.
It made me. I mean, anybody who was following my I don't know if I posted this on Twitter yesterday or not.
You made some gurgling noises and stuff, I think.
I posted somewhere that I was watching these and was just in a complete outrage at having to see what was pretty much one of the worst episodes of television I have ever watched in my life.
And I think outrage is a good choice. You should be outraged. That's what I mean.
I was furious.
Earlier episodes were insipid. They were just stupid. But this one's insulting.
Bad. It is. It is very insulting. I was just angry as I was watching this episode. It's so insulting is a very, very good word. It is so badly written that I felt like the writer had absolutely no care in the world about trying to create any kind of decent quality entertainment for the television viewer, be it 1977 or 2011. It doesn't matter. It should have some kind of – you should care about what you're writing, care about the product. And obviously, the writer, who was Stephen Candel, he clearly didn't.
Stephen Candel?
That's what I found. Yeah, I looked it up.
Let's do a name check on this guy and see what else he's written. Oh, goodness gracious me. MacGyver? Lester?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he wrote an episode. I remember reading that. Yeah.
17 episodes of MacGyver.
I was never a big follower of MacGyver, so I really can't comment on that.
Well, David is a huge MacGyver fan, and he could probably look this list over and tell us if this is the rogues gallery of bad episodes of... He wrote Mike Hammer, and episodes of Heart to Heart, and Dynasty, and stuff. So, I mean, he got Vegas, Nero Wolf, Chips, Dukes of Hazzard, some really classics there. Mm. Super Train! He wrote an episode of Super Train!
Really?
And one of the Amazing Spider-Man, and two of the $6 Million Man.
Oh, well, you've got the set. You'll have to look that up.
Oh, he wrote C.W. Hyde, which is one of the Man from Atlantis.
Ooh,
and he wrote a bunch of Wonder Womans, and Switch, and Hawaii Five-O, and The Bionic Woman, and Cannon, and Harry O, and Barnaby Jones, and Star Trek? Cartoon? Jihad and Mud's Passion. I, Mud. He wrote I, Mud. And
no,
Mud's
that's
Women.
An episode.
And Mud's Women. He wrote all the Mud episodes. I don't think...
This can't be the same person. Did he have a stroke before he wrote this god-awful piece of garbage for Man from Atlantis?
Wow.
Well, there were some good things in that. In that list.
Not necessarily that every episode of those shows were good ones. I don't know, but...
No, but there were some that were pretty good. I mean, Mud's Women really didn't do a whole heck of a lot for me, but I thought I, Mud was a very amusing
show. So you liked I, Mud, but not Mud's Women? Really?
Eugene? Who are you talking to?
Well, I realize that you may not find the Mud's Women to be visually appealing, but as a story, it was a science fiction story, and I, Mud was a farcical, possibly one of my five worst episodes of Star Trek ever.
One of my favorites. I found Mud's Women to be a rather slow plotting story.
I'm not crazy about Mud's Women, but at least it was, you know, it was okay. High Mud was just with the dancing and the fake bombs and the Kirk and his hammy upping. I can see that. I can actually see this episode in that episode now. Now it all begins to come together. I'm beginning to see it. And you know, there were episodes where MacGyver went time traveling.
Oh, no, really?
I think there was like an episode where he got hit on the head and he imagined he was in the Old West. I think so. Now I'm definitely going to get David on this one and find out, because that sounds so much like, in fact, yes, and it is this guy. Exhausted from being overworked, MacGyver falls asleep watching an old Western. He dreams that he's in the Old West, where he encounters Murdoch and Pete, who conspire to force MacGyver off his land.
Well, you said that Stephen Candel also wrote $6 Million Man. Well, you have the set.
I do, and I haven't watched either one of these. The Cross Country Kidnap, I might have. Oh, that was a bad one. Oh, yeah, that was the one with the computer programmer who could undermine our entire U.S. security system, is also an Olympic horse racer, and refuses to quit just because they're going to kill her. Yeah, that was...
Well, that sounds pretty lame.
It was not a very good episode.
What was the other episode?
It's called The Moving Mountain, and I have not gotten to that one yet. I don't remember Steve Austin traveling through time and and getting involved in Hamlet.
No.
Okay, well, we've so way gone off our on our remit.
Oh, but
on that
it's
one.
So far more enjoyable than talking about this piece of garbage.
So I think that's about the best we can do for these episodes. We may or may not come back with a couple more episodes because I don't honestly think we can let the worst piece of television ever made by man go without at least us bashing into it for a little bit. But that won't be next week, I promise you. We wouldn't inflict that on anyone. In the meantime, remember that April 28th is the Fusion Patrol first anniversary, and we are having a contest. All you have to do to win this fabulous hardcover 11th Doctor graphic novel, The Only Good Dalek, is to join up on our forums at FusionPatrol.com. Hop into the thread for the contest and leave us a comment as to what science fiction classic or not so classic you'd like us to look at on future episodes of Fusion Patrol, and you will be entered into a random drawing for the winner, which we'll be doing about the time of our episode on the 28th. The deadline for entering is April 23rd. Why April 23rd? Because that's the premiere of Doctor Who, and it just seems like the way to go. So get your entries in there, and until we come up with another way to torture you with really bad television on Fusion Patrol, we hope you'll join us again next time. Anyway, good night.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Username, Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.